The Precinct Omega Weekly Podcast is supported by Horizon Wars Zero Dark, sci-fi skirmish war games in a fallen earth. Visit Wargame Vault at wargamevault.com and search for Zero Dark.
It's Friday the 13th of November, but there is no bad luck around here. My name is Roby Jenkins, and this week is one of my design discussion episodes that historically, for the last few months, I have been scripting all of my podcasts, basically taking 2-3 hours writing a script and then recording it, which takes 30 to 45 minutes, and then editing that recording and posting it. And that time I've been putting into scripting has getting longer and longer every week. So what I've decided to do this week is ditch the script. Now, the downside with this is that I won't then be able to upload the script to my blog for people to read as well as listen to the podcast. But in some ways, I'd like more people to be listening to the podcast because it's not possible for me to see statistically how many people are reading my blog, but I can see very easily how many people are listening to the podcast, and that's kind of important to me. So this podcast episode is going to be a little bit different, a little bit freer. I'm going to test it, see how it works. I'm aiming for no more than 30 minutes of me talking, and it'll probably be less than that because I'll run out of steam along the way. So in the design episodes, what I'm trying to do is pull out topics, not really in any sort of logical way, more in the case of as stuff occurs to me, as I'm wrestling with things, and unpack a little bit of my experience, talk about how things are dealt with very broadly within the industry, and obviously then talk about how I've approached them in some of my games. So the topic this week, and I'm going to try and pick on a few sort of big meaty topics over the next few weeks. So this week, the topic I want to talk about is stats. That is the numbers that we associate with individual units or individual models within a game to dictate what that unit or model can or can't do. And we're specifically looking at the numbers of the stats, not at special rules or abilities or anything like that, which can just vastly expand stuff, but we're looking at the numbers. And the reason I'm thinking about this week is because I have found myself increasingly drawn very much against my better judgment towards a new genre in literature. And some of you may have heard of this. For some of you, it'll be new. It's called Lit RPG, which means literary roleplay game. And what it fundamentally means is it's a story, a traditional novel type or short story or novella tale where the characters in it have the qualities of a traditional paper and pen roleplay game character. Specifically, they have stats. And they're aware of their stats, and they can see their stats somehow. And the genre, my understanding is that the genre sort of began, interestingly enough, in Russia and has kind of moved westwards and has become very, very popular amongst late Generation Y, Gen Z kids. And I think it's really interesting that there's not really any mainstream literary presence for Lit RPG that I can think of. It is related to those world-jumping traditional fantasy stuff. C.S. Lewis brought it to us, Stephen R. Donaldson with the Thomas Covenant stories. And various other people, you know, a regular person finds themselves in fantasy world. Yes. But Lit RPG doesn't necessarily require a movement between worlds. What it requires is that experience of participating in a role-play game in real life. That's it. Although the sort of fantasy world thing is quite a common trope in the genre. But the reason I've been thinking thinking about this is, first of all, because I've been reading quite a lot of it, and there's almost none of it sort of conventionally published, as I say. It's all online in various sort of sharing sites where people post parts or whole stories for people to read free online. And the other reason is, having read quite a lot of this stuff, and as I say, very much against my better judgment, because there's a real, real mixed bag of both excellent and dreadful within this genre, I have started trying to write my own. And I'm about 27,000-28,000 words into this now. And yeah, at some point I'll probably share it and I'll let you know where it is. But what I found most challenging wasn't the story, which is unusual for me, but keeping track of the stats and understanding what they meant. And as I found that interesting, so the characters in the story started to engage with both the positive and negative aspects of living with real-time stats. And I think it says something really interesting. And I'll get back to the sort of the game design stuff in a moment, but just briefly, I think it says something really interesting about the people with whom these stories are most popular, that there is an element of wish fulfillment in all fantasy, and in this fantasy, the area of wish fulfillment, less the fantasy worlds, is more the experience of being able to see a numerical appraisal of what you're good at, and seeing a direct connection between effort into something and a numerical increase in the value of your skill in that particular area. And I think that's psychologically incredibly interesting, because I think as a generation, there is a real pressure upon that late Gen Y, Gen Z group to associate effort with outcome in a way that they don't see in real life. That, you know, they put a lot of effort into stuff and they don't see the payback from that effort that previous generations, my own included, but particularly the baby boomers, enjoyed from that level of effort. And that's quite frustrating. So there's a real sort of wish fulfillment aspect to seeing a direct connection between effort and payoff in living in a lit RPG narrative. And I wonder if that's part of the appeal, growing appeal to this generation of the traditional pencil and paper RPG game. Anyway, I thought that was really interesting, but as I engage with it, so I become interested, more and more interested, in the question of stats. And obviously I've given a lot of thought to stats in a game context in the past, and so this has sort of brought this back to my mind, and I thought I'd talk about it this week. And I suppose that the challenge that I've really sort of come to engage with through trying to write lit RPG is what I call the reductionist problem, which is the positive side of having your own visual stats is that, yes, you can see a payoff between effort and reward. The downside, the dark side of that, is that you as an individual, as a protagonist in a lit RPG, then become defined by the stats. And it's a common trope in the RPGs that people have levels and other people judge them on the basis of their levels. I am a level 12, you are a level 40, therefore you are better than me and you are a threat to me. And I think that's a really interesting social problem to deal with, and we're already starting to see that reflecting in real life in stuff like the Chinese government's social credit score that they give to citizens, in which people with a higher credit score are, inverted quotes, better than people with a lower social credit score. And, I mean, I hope it's obvious that there's something profoundly disturbing in seeing that reflected in real life, which I don't see reflected in most of the current crop of lit RPG, certainly those that I have read. But turning back to game design, the reductionist issue is one that's very real. Now, it's very real, particularly in roleplay games. And I'm going to refer to a lot of roleplay games, tabletop roleplay games, for the first part of this episode, before I move to miniatures war games, just because it's easier to illustrate this in the context of a roleplay game. But I want you to understand the principles of how it influences the roleplay game so that we can take it back to the miniatures game and see the same thing. It's not on the same level in a war game, but it's there. So probably the best example I could think of looking at my notes of this in a roleplay game is the classic D&D alignment chart. Now, people don't immediately think of an alignment chart as being a numerical thing, but anybody who's done any graph maths recently will know that it is. When you talk about somebody as being lawful good or chaotic evil or true neutral, what you're really doing is plotting a point on a graph. And this should be obvious to anybody given half a thought. If you're not familiar with the alignment chart, I'd find that surprising if you're listening to this podcast, but basically, imagine a graph with two axes. The x-axis goes from good to evil, and the y-axis goes from chaotic to lawful. And at 0, 0, at the centre of the graph, point 0x, 0y, we've got the true neutral. Then at minus 1, plus 1, so minus 1 on the x-axis, plus 1 on the y-axis, we've got lawful good, and at plus 1 minus 1 we've got chaotic evil, and then all the other alignments fall around the graph in that way. So even though we give it a narrative description of chaotic neutral or lawful evil or whatever it might be, that's just a verbal way of expressing a numerical value. So it is a number. So we are placing a number on somebody's morality, which is incredibly interesting, because the alignment chart, as far as I remember, wasn't a part of first edition Dungeons & Dragons. I was very young when first edition came out, so my first encounter with it was at second edition, when there definitely was an alignment chart. As I remember it, the alignment chart was introduced as a way of aiding roleplay. The idea was to articulate the motives of your character so that you could express those motives more confidently in roleplay. It also articulated some of your relationship with the world around you, so that generally speaking, good people and evil people didn't get on. Yeah. And I think there was also an element within it, which has been challenged in recent years, of defining NPC races clearly. So if you defined a race like orcs as evil, this race is an evil race. Therefore, it justified the violent action against those by good characters, or even by evil characters for that matter. You know, they're an evil race. What does it matter if I kill them? They're evil. And that's one of the things that's been challenged in very strongly in recent years, is the idea of defining any NPC race, all of its members, as possessing a moral quality. And that challenge speaks back to the problem within the alignment chart. Now, that I should say, I'm not saying I think we should get rid of the alignment chart. I mean, it's an iconic part of modern popular culture. It has a role to play. But having applied a numerical value to somebody's morality, what you do is shut down options. And if you know people, I mean, if you are a human, you must know that some days you're a good person. You know, some days you're doing not necessarily the right things in the sense of making all the right decisions, but where your heart lies some days is just in the right place. You're out to help your fellow people. You're out to be a positive influence on the world. And that's a conscious effort that you're making. Other days, not so much. I mean, that's true, isn't it? It's true everybody. Even in the course of a day, we can go from being incredibly selfless to utterly selfish in the click of a finger. And that's part of what makes humans interesting. But the moment you place a morality value on a character in a game, you shut down that infinite variety and the variability within human behaviour, which, particularly in a role-play game, seems like a bad idea. Now, right now, I'm not playing any RPGs. Recently finished one, which was awesome. Better still, that one didn't have an alignment chart, not in the sense of the play. But interestingly, my older son has recently... I mean, he's been into D&D for a long time, but he recently discovered that some of his friends at school are also into D&D, and they were all keeping it quite quiet until somebody brought it up, and then all of a sudden, wow, we discovered that within our friendship group, 8 people are into D&D, or at least willing to give it out a try if they'd not heard of it before. And they've now got a really regular roleplay group going on, I think they use Discord, which is amazing. I mean, I love to see games like this just lift a group of friends together like that. But my son's great. He discusses the adventures with me. He's now GMing a little side quest and having a good time. But he also comes and says with challenges. And he'll say, well, how would you resolve this situation? And a really common factor in the things that he comes and talks to me about are the fact that you've got characters who have adopted an alignment, and the players now feel obligated to behave according to that alignment, even when it's detrimental to the fun of the gaming experience. So you've got characters who are, for example, lawful evil, or just for the sake of it, let's say they're lawful evil, and therefore they feel obliged to take certain decisions and do certain things within the course of the game, even when it is reducing the fun of the experience of other players within the game, and is detrimental to the relationships of the party. Now, that makes sense because of their choice of alignment, but it doesn't make sense if they are people. Because even people who are fundamentally bad people can make decisions to do things that are objectively morally good for selfish reasons. So they can do good things because it creates stronger bonds with the people around them, and they are emotionally or financially invested in establishing those bonds. And that's a good illustration of why the alignment chart, the alignment value in a character in D&D can be an obstruction. Now, experienced players will know and embrace this, and everything that I've said they'll already have put into play, and they'll say, well, I've played a lawful evil character for ages and it doesn't cause any problems at all. No, if you're experienced and you understand that, it's not going to. But by the same measure, if you're that experienced and understand the alignment system in that way, you can get rid of the alignment system. You don't need to be told that your character is lawful evil because you have internalized their personality, and you can therefore roleplay it without needing to constantly refer back to their numerically valued alignment. So there is the challenge with the complexity, adding the complexity of an alignment to a character in a roleplay game. And that's just an easy example to call upon. There are plenty of other examples, and there's been a very strong long time turn against the complexity of characters through numerical values in roleplay games, because it leads to this kind of reductionist thinking. And without reeling off lots, I from my own knowledge, things like Amber Diceless, things like Cthulhu Dark, there are others that you can come up with where there has been a conscious push from the designers to get away from imposing numerical values on characters for the sake of play and actually developing games that don't need those numerical values to keep them working. Now, I think that has established where I'm sort of driving, which is adding numbers to increase the complexity, the numerical complexity of a tabletop element, in this case a player character, actually serves as a reductionist measure, reducing the complexity of options available. So the character becomes more complex, the options become more simple, become reduced. So increase in complexity in character leads to reduced complexity in play experience. That is broadly my argument. And if we turn this back to tabletop, we can look at everybody's most familiar tabletop game, Warhammer 40,000. And back when Warhammer 40,000 began, the stat line was, now I'm probably going to get this wrong, so I hope a listener will correct me if I've missed something, but it was movement, weapon skill, ballistic skill, strength, toughness, wounds, initiative, attacks, leadership, intelligence, cool, and willpower. And that stat line was reflected across all of the games in the Warhammer range at that time. We had Warhammer, Warhammer 40,000, Warhammer Fantasy Roleplay, definitely used all of those stats. Today, I haven't played 9th edition yet, and I'm probably not going to, but I did feel moved to go and check and have a look at what the stats looked like, just in case it had changed radically like Age of Sigmar did, but it hasn't. Today, it is movement, weapon skill, ballistic skill, strength, toughness, wounds, attacks, leadership, and save. And some units, I believe, have a feel no pain stat as well. Now, it's still a long stat line, but it's compressed and it's reduced. And one of the things that stands out as being reduced, which I think came at 3rd edition, was they had leadership, intelligence, cool, and willpower, and they compressed all of that to a single stat, which was leadership. Reason being, if you look back at those early stat lines, at leadership, intelligence, cool, and willpower, 9 times out of 10, they all had the same value. In the other cases, 1 or 2 of them would be 1 point different from the others. And that was it. And very sensibly, the designers looked at that and went, well, why don't we just use one stat for all of them? Which they did, and everybody thought it was a great idea. But you can see the motivation within that wasn't just... When we reduce it from the 4 stats to the 1 stat, we're simplifying the game and losing none of the complexity of the tabletop interactions. But if you look back earlier at why did they have those 4 stats to begin with, leadership, intelligence, cool, and willpower was an attempt to articulate the complexity of the characters. These 4 different qualities, 4 different mental and emotional qualities of a tabletop unit that could act differently in different circumstances. And it was very much feeding towards the idea that there'd be different psychological interactions on the tabletop. But in practice, that didn't happen. That all those psychological interactions were actually reduced. And reducing the number of stats didn't reduce the complexity of the interactions. So whilst this isn't like the D&D alignment chart in that adding more numbers was constraining the flexibility of options on the table, it does illustrate that by reducing the number of stats, you lose none of the tabletop complexity. And I think that decision way back in 90-something to reduce those 4 stats to 1 stayed with me, because when I started writing games, my first approach was, how few stats can I get away with using? But when I did that, first of all, you know, my thinking wasn't, well, more stats actually reduces complexity, therefore I want to maximize the complexity of interactions on the table. I wasn't thinking that intellectually about the process. It was really just an exercise in my own entertainment to say, how simple can I make a game and still make it entertaining, I guess, and still be a miniatures game. And I carried across that experience because it was a very fruitful and satisfying experience that you really could create very diverse interactions with a very limited number of stats. And that was with my first experience in writing a miniatures game, which was Scrapyard. And I held on to that when I moved to start writing Horizon Wars. And in Horizon Wars, we have M, F, A, and D. Movement, firepower, armor, and defense. And looking back, oh, and I should say there's also a stat called presence. So five stats. Presence, move, mobility, firepower, armor, and defense. And I suppose looking back, if I had a regret, it was that I didn't sufficiently distinguish armor and defense in the narrative because those words sound too familiar. Armor could also have been agility, and I might have just made it agility, and defense could have been damage control. Somebody mentioned that earlier because they thought it stood for damage control, and I thought, God, that would have been so much better than calling it defense. So that's how it works. But how I approached the idea of these four stats was by writing how the game worked and then working out how I could use those stats within the game. And I added and subtracted stats as the design developed, but broadly speaking, it settled into those four stats very quickly. I mean, looking back, the core rules for Horizon Wars were written in the course of about 45 minutes. And I can remember sitting in bed of an evening. You know, we'd gone to bed and I didn't have a book to read. And I thought, I've got this idea for a game. What am I going to do? And I had a notebook and a pencil. And I sketched out these ideas in about 45 minutes. And then worked out how the game would work around these stats and whether I needed anything else. And broadly speaking, the answer was no. I worked out really quite quickly that everything I wanted to do in the game, I could do with these stats. Anything I wanted to do that I couldn't do with these stats, I either dropped from the game or I modified it until I could work it with the stats. And I probably could have got away with three stats, I'll be honest. I'm glad I didn't, because then, of course, having written Horizon Wars, I then came to write Zero Dark a couple of years ago. And Zero Dark is one of those games that took years. I mean, if Horizon Wars took 45 minutes to come into shape, Zero Dark took 3 years. I tried so many different things, and none of them quite gelled or worked in the way I wanted it to. And it wasn't until I hit upon a realization that the stats of a game are part of how it identifies itself to its community. And if you look at Warhammer, if you look at Dungeons & Dragons, obviously the classic ones, look at Infinity, you look at Malifaux, look at War Machine, whatever, those stats that they use have a coherence across games that people can tell what game you're playing just by looking at a stat line if they know it. And they all have different stat lines. There are resemblances and there are commonalities, of course, but the stat line becomes part of the identity of the game. And when I clued on that, I realized that there was a marketing reason as well as a mechanical reason. That people who are familiar with a stat line become comfortable within the environment of those mechanics. And I thought, that's what I want to carry across to Zero Dark. You know, people who've played Horizon Wars and enjoyed Horizon Wars, who trust Horizon Wars, are going to be my first audience for Zero Dark. Therefore, I want to offer them something familiar so that they have faith in the underpinning mechanics of the game when they move across. So I realised I needed to build Zero Dark on the same foundations as Horizon Wars. And with that realisation, everything more or less fell into place. Not within 45 minutes, but within days, rather than the years it had taken up to that point. And so I carried across M, F, A and D, but I redefined them somewhat. They became mobility still, fight, acuity and discipline. So we had two physical and two mental stats. But again, having nailed that down, I then started writing the game around those stats on the basis of how can I make these stats be sufficient to run my game. Now, you do have to also, I think, be open to the idea that two things are true. First of all, you may want to add stuff, and I did. In Zero Dark, I wanted to, in the end, to add armor value and firewall as additional stats. They work differently to the other four, but they're there as stats. There's no avoiding it. But one can also say, oh, was there not some way of eliminating those stats too? Well, yes, of course there was. But the other thing that, you know, it's easy when you're talking about the maths of a game to get wrapped up in the intellectual exercise of writing an efficient game. And I'm guilty of that sometimes, I know that. But at the same time, now that I'm more invested in the commercial success of my games, one also becomes aware of the expectations of your players. And those expectations include seeing things that are familiar. And that covered things like armor value and firewall. I say familiar, the idea of the opponent makes an attack, I have some form of way of mitigating that attack is a very, very popular interaction in tabletop war games for the simple reason that people want to feel a level of agency. You know, when the enemy is shooting at you, you want to feel like you've got some agency in order to, as I say, to mitigate that assault upon your character. So taking that away, although mechanically it can work, psychologically it can be harmful. So that's how I approach stats for Horizon Wars and Zero Dark. We're always trying to trim away, to reduce complexity in the characters, because my experience is that by reducing that complexity, you enhance the complexity on the tabletop. And I've talked before about games that lose the focus on the tabletop and drive it somewhere else, whether it's to the character cards or to the deck or to a dice mechanic or whatever it is. What we want to push our players focus towards in any tabletop miniatures war game is towards the miniatures. The more time they spend looking at the miniatures and visualizing the interactions of those miniatures, the more fun I believe a game is. The more time somebody spends staring at a piece of paper or a card or a deck of cards, the less fun the game is, and therefore the less engaging the game will be. I've passed through 30 minutes now on this. I think I've kept a coherent argument. I think I've conveyed some useful stuff. Please let me know, did you prefer listening to me talking just with notes and no script, or did you find it easier to listen to me on a script? I'd love to hear your thoughts. I've also set up my desk now so that not only can I record this audio style, but I could also record this video style. If you were interested enough that you wanted to actually watch me talk on YouTube, do let me know. It would be literally no additional effort for me to record this video style when I don't have to look at a script and I can actually look at the camera. All right. So leave comments either on Podbean or on Patreon. If you're a Patreon subscriber, let me know what you think. As I said a few episodes ago, this podcast is now going out on Podbean, on Spotify, on Apple Podcasts, and on Google Podcasts. Whichever one you listen to, please do subscribe, follow, whatever it might be. Everything really helps the visibility of the podcast. If you think other people should listen to this podcast and would get some fun and enjoyment out of it, add a follow, add a subscribe. Better still, add a review. 5 stars are better, naturally, but I don't mind honest feedback because it all increases the visibility of the podcast. So if you want to share it with other people, that's by far the best way to share it. Thank you very much to everybody who's listening. And next week, we'll be back to a scripted thing. We'll be doing news. And I hope, if I can organise it, I will be joined by a guest. But as I haven't invited anybody officially yet, we'll wait and see. But I do have some guests lined up. I look forward to having them on the podcast. So thank you for listening, everybody, and I will speak to you again next week.
The Precinct Omega Game Design Podcast is supported by our patrons on Patreon. Go to patreon.com/Precinct Omega to help us continue developing new games and creating hobby content for wargames enthusiasts all over the world.